found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard here live every weekday morning at 9 o'clock on LATalkRadio.com, and then later on demand for download for your device to your Android or to your iPhone for free apps at MariaSanchezShow.com and TheMariaSanchezShow.com. We're live. It's Monday, June 17th. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope you had a fabulous weekend and a terrific Father's Day. Coming up on this program this morning, we have a clinical neuropsychologist from Uruguay visiting with us. He's a U.S. licensed clinical neuropsychologist, about the mind-body connection and centenarians. They're the fastest growing segment of the population here in the United States. And since genes only account for 30% of our longevity, he has some theories about our immune system and how we too can achieve that result, meaning going to be 100 plus and do it healthily. And then later on in the broadcast, we have a man who is promoting products made right here in the United States. He's amassed over 3,100 companies, and he's going to share that with us. But we'll get into the news, and again, the NSA leaker Edward Snowden is in the news because today China made its first substantive comments about that, demanding that Washington explain its monitoring programs to the international community. And this was said at a daily briefing by the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson. Quote, "We believe the United States should pay attention to the international community's concerns and demands and give the international community the necessary explanation." So they haven't commented previously directly on the case, simply saying in the past 2 weeks that they are one of the world's biggest victims of hacking attacks. And Snowden told the South China Morning Post, which is Hong Kong's main English language newspaper, last week that Americans had spied extensively on targets in China and Hong Kong, including the Chinese University of Hong Kong, which handles nearly all the city's domestic web traffic. So far, he has not been charged with any crime. In a poll on the website of the Global Times, which is a popular newspaper published by the Communist Party official, People's Daily, 98% of respondents said China should refuse to send Edward Snowden back to the United States. In an editorial, they say, "Unlike a common criminal, Snowden did not hurt anybody. His crime is that he blew the whistle on the U.S. government's violation of civil rights. His whistleblowing is in the global public interest. Therefore, extraditing Snowden back to the United States would not only be a betrayal of Snowden's trust, but a disappointment for expectations around the world. The image of Hong Kong would be forever tarnished." His, Edward Snowden's, father is also in the news today. He did an interview, and he's imploring his son, "You're a man of principle. I know you're going to do the right thing. Please don't share any more information." So there was also a march in Hong Kong on Saturday by a few hundred rights advocates to demand protection for him. They gathered outside the U.S. consulate. They shouted, "Arrest Obama, free Snowden, betray freedom. Big Brother is watching you. Obama is checking your email." And Hong Kong's largest pro-Beijing political party, the DAB, demanded an apology for Washington over clarification of illegal espionage activities and an immediate halt to them. So apparently there's more and more information. We shared with you on Friday what the latest information came out about Snowden, about his online antics, if you will, his postings, the blogs that he participated in. They're calling them, the millennials, the internet people, and what they're doing. So it's the story keeps unfolding. Another story in the banking scandal has made the news today. Six former Bank of America employees have alleged that the bank deliberately denied eligible homeowners loan modifications and lied to them about the status of their mortgage payments and documents. Now, I have a dear friend that works for Bank of America in the loan modification plan, and he's told me privately, so I won't share with you things that he said because I don't want to get him in trouble, that that's been happening under his watch. He's seen it happen, that they're told on the screen that it's in foreclosure, but to accept as many payments as possible to dupe the people. So this is making the news because it's gotten legal. The bank allegedly used these tactics to shepherd homeowners into foreclosure as well as in-house loan modifications, yielding the bank more profits than if they had followed the government-sponsored Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP as it's known as. So it goes on and on that they said that the bank would reward customer service representatives who foreclosed on homes with cash bonuses and gift cards to retail stores such as Target and Bed Bath & Beyond. For an example, an employee who placed 10 or more accounts into foreclosure a month could get a $500 bonus. At the same time, the bank punished those who did not make the numbers or objected to its tactics with discipline, including firing. And then here's something lovely. About twice a month, the bank would clean out its HAMP backlog in an operation called Blitz, where it declined thousands of loan modification requests just because the documents were more than 60 months old. So it goes on and on. It's really upsetting. I was sharing over the weekend with a girlfriend who's a realtor, because here in Southern California and Los Angeles specifically, prices are rebounding nicely, and there's a house that just went on the market yesterday up my street that restores my value to the home, which I purchased in, we closed in November of 2005. So I bought my home under circumstances that don't exist. I was in over my head. It had to do with my divorce and what was promised and what ended up not happening. And I found myself unable actually to afford my home. So in the fall of 2008, now my lender is Chase, I contacted Chase, and at that time they did a cursory review and they said I didn't have enough debt. My debt to income ratio wasn't high enough. So then I contacted them again in the spring of 2009. Went through the whole process, and it is arduous and laborious and unbelievably detailed. And Father's Day weekend of June 2009, on a Saturday, I remember I was in San Diego with my folks, they denied me again. I started all over again in 2010 and went through 18 months of sending in documents, faxing documents, registering documents, signing things, notarizing things, emails, phone calls, back and forth, faxes. It was mind-boggling. And in July of 2010, I was actually awarded a modification. I'll never forget. I got the phone call. I was just leaving my Rotary meeting, and I had been given a different gal or a guy once a month, and every month then I would get a new phone call and start all over with a new person and new documentation. I swear to goodness, my files are at least a foot tall with everything that I had to provide for them over and over and over again. Finally, I got this one gal for some whatever reason, because things were changing and, you know, more wrongdoing was being exposed, and I guess they were tinkering with the system. So this one woman ended up staying with me. I think we had a 6-month relationship or something. I never did get a chance to meet her. But she called me as I got out of my Rotary meeting. She says, Maria, I need you to focus. And I was like, okay. And she says, you've been approved. And I just burst into tears. It was like, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. So I took the documentation that Chase sent me to a real estate attorney for him to review to make sure that what I thought I was signing was indeed what I was signing, because it was in it was legalese. And when I brought it to him and he looks at the paperwork, he goes, Maria, I have done 100 of these. I have not gotten a single one approved. What in the world did you do? And I was like, I was persistent. I was tireless. I got people involved, like our congressman. I called him. He called me back. I told him what was going on. He said, please use my name. I emailed actually Jamie Dimon, who's the chair and CEO of Chase, JPMorgan Chase, I think four times I sent him letters, registered and stuff, detailing what was going on, what was wrong with the system, what I was in, and I got responses. So I'm not saying that I got special treatment, but I wouldn't take no for an answer. So when I told this girlfriend realtor yesterday, we had this conversation as a matter of fact, that I had gotten the loan approval, she said, you are like, I don't know, 1% is getting the approval. And I was like, okay, well, so I'm happy to say that the system that I pursued does work, and I have those results. So Bank of America, shame on you if that's what's going on. And if you're in it, keep on keeping on. I'd like to give you hope in that regard. So now we're going to be speaking with Dr. Mario E. Martinez in Uruguay about the mind-body connection, and his study was centenarians, the fastest growing segment of the population in the United States. Good morning. We spoke with him already. Must still be dialing. It's amazing. So that we're speaking with somebody in Uruguay, and then we're going to speak with somebody about buying products in the United States. Right, maybe I'll start over again. Call. Good old technology. Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show. Pardon the interlude.
Hello?
Hi, good morning. This is Maria
Hello?
Sanchez. Are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's Maria. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Oh, boy. That's odd.
Hello?
I'm here.
Hello?
I'm going to hang up and we're going to call again. We already spoke this morning, so that's odd. Excuse me. Technology at its finest. A clinical neuropsychologist. And he proposes that cultural and spiritual beliefs are more significant than genetics in the process of health and longevity. So this is a particular topic that we love to promote. It's like, you know, good news that we do have control over our destiny and we do have control over the quality of life. And then the immune system. If we hadn't spoken already, I would be concerned, but we did speak before the broadcast. I know what I'll do. I'm going to play you a jingle, and then I'll dial him.
The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hello.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Martinez there. Sorry for those aborted attempts. You couldn't hear me. I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it's good now.
Yes. Thank you. First of all, Dr. Mario E. Martinez, the founder of Biocognitive Science and a U.S. licensed clinical neuropsychologist. Thank you for joining us. And your topic, our discussion, is so like what we do is we try and promote good news as much as possible. So I love the fact that we're talking about something that we have the ability to control or change in our lives and regarding our health and our longevity and our quality of existence. But let us know initially, clinical neuropsychologist, what does that mean exactly?
That's a specialty in clinical psychology that actually works with any illness or any psychological problem that affects the brain. So if you have, for example, Alzheimer's, what is the effect on the brain and the cognition and any kind of disorder? But the way that I learned neuropsychology, which is still being taught that way, is that we study the sick brain. We study the damaged brain. And when there's damage to a certain part of the brain, then we know that some part doesn't work. But there's a new science now in neuroscience called cultural neuroscience that's studying the healthy brain. And we get a completely different picture of what we learn. It's much more plastic. It has much more possibilities of change. And what we thought was a kind of a bipolar on or off, it's not like that. It's a gradient process.
So my understanding is that you're going to be able to empower us to understand that we have control over our disposition, over our health, over our immune system more than we have thought, because we usually think we default to genetics.
Yes, that's what I was taught, that genetics is really the guiding force of the expression of illness and health. And it's not that way at all. And people are born with a causes of health, and I think that, for example, longevity and illnesses are learned, not intellectually, but I hope to have a little time to explain it. But, for example, a genetics is just a predisposition of something, and the actual percentage of gene errors when you're born is very, very small. It's 2-3%. The rest, you're born healthy, and then gradually you express propensities based on the lifestyle, based on the culture, and based on many other factors, the environment, that have to do with external forces and external conditions rather than just being a genetic sentence, which is not that way. And so you're told, for example, well, if you have cancer in your family, then most likely you're going to die of cancer. That's ridiculous. That's not science. That's only a probability. And what happens is that the person learns the helplessness that leads them to increase the probability of cancer, because cancer is basically an under immunity. It's a low response of the immune system, and then the cancer cell and precancer cells grow and then develop cancer.
So tell us about what drew you to research centenarians, and that being people 100 years old or over, and all over the world, you say.
Well, because conventional science studies the averages. It's a science of averages. It only looks at averages, how long you're going to live on the average, the illness prognosis on the average, and that's why it fails miserably with systems problems. It doesn't cure anything. It's magical. It's wonderful with acute problems. But when it comes to systemics, it doesn't cure anything because it's looking at the average. So I started looking at the both sides of the curve. Especially on the right side of the curve, who are the people that live long, healthy lives, and what is it? What can I attribute it to? And I started studying it at first with this reductionistic mindset, and I thought, well, it's got to be genetics. And I started looking into it in different five continents, and I find that's really an average of 25 to at most 35% that you can account for genetics. The rest is environmental. The rest is mainly cultural beliefs. These people have a different way of looking at the world. They're not trying to live longer. It's just that the way they live longer, healthy. So all those admonitions about if you live long enough, you're going to die of cancer, and all those kinds of admonitions that are basically not science don't hold true with centenarians. They die in their sleep, or they die falling off horses. It's totally different. So then I started looking into it at what does good science do? It looks at what works, and it comes up with theories of what works rather than what doesn't work. And that's how I developed then the biocognitive concept of learning longevity.
So in terms of, like, are there 10 steps, or are there, is it spiritually based, or is it based on, you know, the goodness or optimistic, or is it based on, are there things that you can actually identify that are tools that we can use?
Yes, and that's what the learning process is. One of the things, several things that I learned from centenarians. Number one, they don't consider that such a thing as middle age. They don't. If you ask them what's middle age, some of them will say, "Well, we don't know. That's just ridiculous. You find out when you die." Number one, middle age is a very, very important component, because a culture will determine what your middle age is, and that's just a cultural portal. But it becomes biological, because you start attributing things. Well, I'm middle-aged. I don't think I can go back to college. Well, I'm middle-aged. I don't think I should do this anymore. And that kind of admonition, that kind of portal that I call portal control, is what actually ages you and what actually changes your biology. That's one. Another thing is that they don't retire. They do what they love. And if you ask them, when are you going to retire? Why should I retire from something that I love? There's a centenarian, Fatua Singh. He's a Hindu, British. He just finished a marathon at 101, and he's retiring from the marathon and moving into something else. Something else that they do. Some of them smoke, and I'm not promoting this, but I'm just reporting. Some of them smoke, some of them drink, but the key is that they do it moderately. And they don't do it to anesthetize themselves. They don't do it to reduce their anxiety. They do it as a ritual. One rum before going to sleep. One cigar before going to sleep. And that's it. And you ask them, do you need any more? No, this is my ritual. And a ritual is really a way of identifying yourself with yourself and your culture. But what happens is that we use drugs and we use alcohol and we use things to distract us from our own anxiety and as a medication rather than as a ritual. So I'm not suggesting that people should smoke. What I'm saying is that what I found is not what I was expecting to find.
Now, how does stress and anxiety impact them? Or how do they deal with that? Did you look into that?
Yes. Stress doesn't exist outside of yourself. That's another myth, that there's stressful things. There's nothing stressful. Stress is an interpretation that you make based on your cultural beliefs and based on your context. If you are in a lecture hall and you're talking about nutrition and a lion walks in, that's stressful because it's out of context. But if you're in that same place doing a conference on lion taming, then the lion comes in and says, oh, here's an opportunity to tame a lion. So it's an interpretation. And what they do is they interpret things in a very resilient way. Something happens, for example, one of them in Ecuador at 101 lost a sight, his eyesight. So they were investigating him from some of the researchers from Harvard, and immediately they're trying to impose pathology, and they said, well, I guess you must be very depressed because you lost your sight. You see, it's an induction of something. And he said, no, I'm not depressed at all. I'm very happy because now when I see a woman or I meet a woman, I have to touch her to find out who she is. So you see, that resilience is a kind of, and the women would do the same thing. It's not chauvinistic. The woman would probably say, I'd have to touch a man out to find out who he is. So that kind of navigating process that they have, they're not Pollyannish. They don't say, oh, how I'm so glad that I have lost my vision. It's just that they embody what they feel, they let it go, and they move on and they find something positive, not intellectual, but something positive, very experiential, of what happened in their lives. So those are some of the things that I think are really that you can begin to change. But the most important thing is that you can begin to give up the myth that aging is a deteriorating process, that aging is a reduction of cognitive function. None of that is true. Your brain becomes more complex. The problem is that we inherited a biology that borrowed from physics, which is really great with carburetors and planets, but not very good with living systems. So physics has entropy, which says you go from order to disorder, and it doesn't work that way. The living systems go from order, not from order to disorder, but they go from simple to complex. You become more complex as you age. You don't become weaker. Now, if you get sick, you can become weaker, not because you're aging, but because you're sick.
But as we age, we do, I don't know that deteriorate would be the right word, but we do. We don't have the same, you know, agility. We don't have the same endurance. We don't have the same strength. We don't have the same bone density. Our musculature changes. But so that's aging, as opposed to crumbling or, you know, becoming obsolete. Is that what you're saying?
It's depending on what you do. This marathon runner is 101. So what happens is that if you fall into portals, and those portals will tell you what you can and cannot do, and then you start attributing things to the portal. So if you're 75 and you're driving a Porsche and your back hurts, immediately you say, I need to get another car because I'm too old. If you're 30, you're in a portal that it's okay to have a Porsche, and you say, I better do some stretching, some yoga, or go for a walk. And those kind of attributions are the things that actually deteriorate your body. Mm. There's no question that there's some slowing down, and there is a process that that changes you. But a very, very large percentage of it is the attribution that you give to things. So, for example, I'll give you another one. In Peru, women, when they have menopause, they call it bochorno. And in Spanish, that means shame. So the hot flashes are the shaming. I have the shames today. And we know now from psychoneuroimmunology that when you are shamed, your body and your immune system specifically will release some molecules, interleukins 2 and others, that actually cause inflammation, as if you're having a wound. So women in Peru will have a very high level of inflammation during their menopause, and especially when they're having the hot flashes. Go to another culture. You go to Japan. Japan, the women consider menopause, their culture considers it, a second spring. an opportunity to move into wisdom, an opportunity to move into a place of honor. They don't have the inflammation that the women in Peru have. Mm-hmm. So you see, it's a it's a biocultural process, not just a reductionist biological process of deterioration.
Well, and I've heard my internist is really into East-West medicine, which is the reason I chose him to be my primary care physician. And when I was having the first hints of the change, he said to me, Maria, other cultures celebrate and actually elevate women that have gone through the change because they are considered now wise. So why don't you just embrace that? It's like, okay, that's a nice way to look at it.
And it is, and it's an existence. It's not just intellectually. But what happens, though, is if you're in a culture here and you say, well, I'm going into Second Spring, the co-authors of the negativity and the misery will say, well, yeah, that's nice, but look, you're 50, what do you want? And they start killing that concept. They start killing that probability that you have of coming out of that culture and transcending those portals and beginning to become unique rather than part of that average that medicine looks into as if it were reality. It's only you're not an average, you're a person in a curve. But when you're doing clinical trials, what happens is that they exclude the things from both sides of the curve, and they call them nuisance variables. Can you imagine that? A placebo, a nuisance variable. And that's why we're where we are. It's become a multi-billion-dollar business of palliative care rather than curing.
So, Dr.
And I'm not against,
Martinez,
I think medicine is wonderful, but I'm just giving the limitations.
If we aren't innately geared that way, I happen to be an optimistic person. I happen to be a glass half full person. I've always been that, and I've been accused of having rose colored glasses. I don't know why, and I certainly have lots of reasons not to, but in general, that's my philosophy of life, and I tend to be a happy person. But if somebody isn't, quote, wired that way, are there ways to reroute the brain so that you look at things in a different way, that you're suggesting these long-living people do that innately?
Yes, because they're not wired that way. Perception is learned, and perception is cultural. So you're not really wired. You have learned a system, and your brain creates neuromaps to support that system. If you, for example, if you're a negative person and everything that you see is negative, you have tremendous amount of neuromaps that actually confirm the perception of negativity, and they'll say, it's raining today. Oh, what a terrible day. Somebody else has a different way of looking. Oh, what a mystical day, or what a lovely day, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that it's not a Pollyanna-ish thing where you can say, oh, I'm so happy today, if you're not. You have to embody what you're feeling first. You have to go to your body and see what your body's saying. And then once you see what your body is doing, then you can begin to make the changes and begin to look at other things to give you a perspective that it's not all black or white, good or bad, but it's a learned process. We're not wired. We have predispositions to learn language, to learn perception. Is cultural, completely cultural.
And so now you have an audiobook about the mind-body code. Does that talk about what we're talking about, the steps to go through it?
Yes, because I think that a lot of theories will talk about things, but they don't give you practical examples. They don't land it in exercises. And what I did with this CD is it actually talks about centenarians, and it gives you techniques of learning centenarian consciousness, guardians of the heart, which is a way of looking at relationships and archetypal wounds and techniques. So each of them has a way of you learning to incorporate these things, not just theoretically pondering, but actually putting them into practice in your everyday life.
And what can you tell us briefly about the segment on relationships?
Relationships, I think what happens is that if you read all these books on relationships about compromising, if you hate football and this week you go to football, that doesn't work. That's for robots. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is you have to work first on the wounds that you bring into a relationship, abandonment, betrayal, shame, and so you don't speak those wounds in your relationship. And in the CD, I talk about how to actually work that out and identify it. But not to create a quid pro quo kind of relationship. If you do this today, I do that tomorrow. Or you hurt me today, so I'm going to hurt you tomorrow. You get out of that. You move out of that, and you move into more of an opportunity to heal each other, an opportunity to grow, an opportunity to create something better than each of you can contribute. The relationship becomes something more powerful than the individual. The individual contributes to the relationship, and that has a very powerful healing effect, and it also helps with longevity, because if you're living a healthy life, then your immune and nervous and endocrine system are going to be healthy.
And so, speaking of abandonment, describe that in case folks don't know what that means emotionally or psychologically, and then talk about addressing that.
Yes, what I have found in all the cultures that I studied is that the good news is that you can only be wounded in three ways by the cultures. Those wounds are, and I call them archetypal because I see them all across cultures. You can be abandoned, you can be betrayed, or you can be shamed. And that doesn't mean that it just happens once. But if you, for example, have a father or a mother that emotionally is not there, or that abandons you in a sense of you go to school and the first day of kindergarten, she's not there, and everybody's there, and then the next day she's not there. So you learn that pattern of abandonment. And what happens then is you learn a language of abandonment wrapped around love, because someone that loved you, someone that you needed, taught you that. So you speak abandonment, and that's where then you get into relationships where you abandon or you get abandoned. And then you wonder why this is happening. Well, because you speak in an intimate language that can only entangle love with abandonment, the only way that you can communicate. And if it's shame, the same way. If it's betrayal, the same way. And then I have worked out what I call healing fields, which actually work through the wounds and allow you to then move into a place where love is untangled from wounds. And these wounds, as for example, as you know now, if you happen to have a shaming wound, you have a propensity to have more inflammation. And in fact, there are quite a few studies that have been looking into inflammation from the psychological point of view. My mentor, George Solomon, who coined the word psychoimmunology and then changed to psychoimmunology, found that many women who have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an inflammatory illness, have a shaming wound and have an early experience of shame as a pattern. You see, it's biocultural, affecting your nervous, immune, and endocrine system.
So the good news is there's hope. And it's interesting that you say there are three wounds regardless of the culture. So abandoned,
yes.
Betrayal, and shame. And betrayal,
yes.
I guess that could be somebody cheating on you, or somebody stealing from you, or somebody backstabbing you, or I guess that they all can have different ramifications of the word or the symptom or the what
yes.
It feels like.
Someone playing with someone tricking your faith. Someone playing with your faith. Please don't tell anybody what I just told you, and then you find that the person tells everybody. It's a betrayal of a faith in someone, and they each have. It's very interesting when we do the techniques and on deep relaxation and teach people to actually experience the wound and clean it up. Abandonment has a coldness to it. When you feel abandoned, you feel cold. Betrayal and shame has a hot temperature to it. And you notice when people are ashamed, they turn red, and when mm-hmm. people get angry, they turn red. And you can actually see a little child feeling for example, the betrayal. You tell them, okay, I want you to do a little dance, and if you do, I'm going to give you this candy. Do it again, and I'll give you the candy. The third time you say, no, I'm not going to give it to you. The child doesn't feel shame of abandonment. The child gets angry. And that is the betrayal of the trust. So those three wounds, the culture decides how they're going to wound you, but within those three wounds. So, for example, you live in Spain, and your father can wound you with shame by telling you that you didn't make the soccer team and you're worthless. You're from East Africa, and you're a Maasai, and you're 14, and you don't kill your first lion as the rites of passage, and your father could also shame you. Well, they did different ways of shaming, but the psychoneuroimmunological reaction is going to be the same. Inflammation and a poor immunity.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We're going to post, your website is biocognitive.com, and we'll post that when we post this conversation later today. And I hope you'll visit with us again, because you've got so much more to share.
Thank you, Maria, and I want to thank you for the fine work that you do also.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your time and making yourself available from Uruguay, no less. Dr. Mario E. Martinez was our guest, and he's got the Mind-Body Code, How the Mind Wounds and Heals the Body. He also wrote The Man from Autumn, a psychological novel. So he is a clinical neuropsychologist. And before we get to our next guest, along the line of some good news, volunteering might literally be good for your heart, a new study suggests. This comes out of Carnegie Mellon University. They found an association between volunteerism and decreased risk of high blood pressure, which is, of course, a major risk factor for heart attack, stroke, heart failure, metabolic syndrome. There's a strong evidence that having good social connection promotes healthy aging and reduces risk for a number of negative health outcomes. That's their summation. So it's published in the Journal of Psychology and Aging. It included almost 1,200 adults between the ages of 51 and 91 who all had normal blood pressure levels at the beginning of the study, which was in 2006. Then they interviewed the study participants about their volunteerism and other factors at the start of the study, and then at the end, again, which was in 2010, and of course had their blood pressure taken at the end of the study. They found that older adults, that was 51 to 91, who spend at least 20 hours a year volunteering, seem to have a 40% lower risk of high blood pressure by the end of the study compared with those who didn't volunteer at all. And researchers didn't find that a type of volunteer work seemed to matter in lowering the hypertension risk, just that you were giving of yourself, so other-centered. Our findings suggest that volunteerism may be an effective non-pharmacological intervention for reducing hypertension risk. And volunteering also, a study earlier this year published in the JAMA Pediatrics, said that volunteering is linked with lower inflammation, cholesterol, and body mass indexes in high schoolers. So it has got beneficial effects no matter what your age range. So if you don't volunteer, you might want to think to do it. It's supposed to be about altruism, but obviously it's a win-win.
Hello.
Hi, Gunter. This is Maria Sanchez. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, and thank you for making yourself available.
Hi, Maria. Happy to talk to you.
Yes, good morning. Tell us why you are making U.S. products known and available via your website, which is fairly extensive and really great to read. And maybe you can just start from the overview about, do you know which country has?
Yes, the reason I started to put the list together was I found it harder and harder to find U.S.-made products. Like, my wife would ask me, you know, she wanted to buy something. And I'd say, well, why don't you look for a U.S.-made product? And she'd say, well, where? And that's the problem. The large retail stores, the chains, and most of the stores, they don't really have much of a U.S.-made selection anymore. They're selling more and more imports,
mm-hmm.
and just ignoring what's being made in the U.S. And I started to research it myself. I said, no, that can't be. There has to be lots of products. And It takes time. I put all this together. It's an ongoing project now for 9 months, but I've gotten up to 3,000 different companies that make products here, and I've categorized them. There's categories like clothing, appliances, furniture, personal care items, but also computers, tools, musical instruments, audio-video equipment, and there's many more. And when I started putting them together, I started to realize, wow, I never knew that we made so many things still here, because usually you always hear imports.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few U.S. products. And that was the letter I sent you, was where I started compiling and counting up the different categories, and I was just amazed. Like, I didn't know that we had 20 different companies that make motorcycles in the U.S. Before I started, I thought, Harley-Davidson, that's it.
Right.
But there's so many. And I didn't know that we have our own coffee and our own tea company and our own olive oil makers here. Because normally, you know, you go to the store, you look, and it's all imports. You don't really have any great selection. And that's the problem. The retailers, they just look for the quick profit by selling imports, and they just ignore what we make here in the U.S. And we make the best products in the world here. And it's just a shame, because consumers become complacent. They trust the store is going to show them a large variety of items, yet they go there and they see less and less U.S. products, and eventually there's none. And you know, I just couldn't believe that there are none. So that's why I wanted to put the list together and make it available to people, so that they can have one place where they can go and see, here, these are all the products that we make in the U.S. And an import instead because I can't find anything.
Well, some of the things that I was fascinated by on your list are like the companies that grow and sell their own tea.
Right. I mean, I didn't even know we did that.
Me either. And I, you know, I think, you know, of Asia basically, or in terms of tea, or companies that make blue cheese.
Right. The first thing when you think blue cheese is French or Danish. Mm-hmm. But the fact is we have like 20 different cheesemakers here in the U.S. that make blue cheese. And that's the problem. They get ignored in the big stores. You don't really see them.
So the question is if we go to your website and we find items that are available but they're not available locally, I guess we could go then to the company's websites and order it online.
Right. Numerous products you can order online. But if it's something like cheese or something, you would go to your local store and you would tell them, you say, why aren't you selling U.S.-made cheese? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this company makes U.S. cheese. Why don't you buy this? I don't want to buy an import. And that's really what the consumer needs to do, because you shouldn't just accept what a store shows you, because the store wants to make money. And if you say to them, you want to buy U.S., you don't want all the imports that they're selling, then they'll have to accommodate you. Otherwise, you'll take your business elsewhere.
And then olive oil.
Exactly. I know. I heard you yesterday talking about you like Spanish. Spanish olive oil?
Yes, love Spanish olive oil.
Yeah, we have 20 different companies that grow olive oil in the U.S. in Texas and Georgia and California, of course.
Yes.
Again, I was just amazed. I didn't know we had so many.
And then the vodka. I know of one, Tito's, out of Texas. You say there's 30 vodka distilleries in the United States?
Exactly. Yes, and that's what's fun when putting this list together. All of a sudden, you find all these little companies all over the place in the U.S. and you know they don't really have the marketing budgets that the big companies do, so it's harder to find them. And that's why I wanted to put them on the list, so people don't have to do the research. They don't have to spend their time looking. They can just go there and say, "Wow, here, look at all this. This is all the things that we make here." And you know, it's a good feeling. Like clothing, for example. I mean, clothing is like the biggest culprit. You go to a store, and practically everything is now from a third world country. There's like nothing left in the U.S. But we have over 400 companies in the U.S. that still make clothes here. We have 80 companies that make shoes in the U.S. And socks, we have 20 companies that only make socks in the U.S.
And coffee.
Exactly. I didn't know. Hawaii, we have 60 companies there that grow coffee and sell coffee. And the fact is, if you go to your local store, all the coffees there, you might know the brands. They might be American brands, but all their coffee is coming from somewhere else. It's not U.S. coffee.
You know, it's funny because I buy organic fair trade coffee beans, but I don't necessarily pay attention to where they're from. So fair trade would suggest that they're not domestic, I would imagine.
Exactly, yes, yes. They're emphasizing that it's a third world and that they're paying them a decent salary.
So what has your journey been like, Gunther, since you've been doing this for 9 months? And how are you getting the word out? I mean, I know you contacted me, and you're a perfect story for our program because you're being active and you're promoting local and all the things that we espouse to or for.
I'm searching out all the companies, and I contact them, and they're usually always surprised to hear from me. They're always happy to get some free publicity. So they're always positively responsive, and they'll promote the website if they can. You know, they'll put it on their blogs or their Facebook pages or their company pages. And I also email all the people who I think, you know, who have blogs that are pro US US products. I try to promote it that way. I mean, I'll send it out to as many people as I can who look like they're interested and have an interest. But you know, there's only so much you can do. People really need to have an incentive. I mean, it needs to come from people themselves that they want to buy U.S. and that they understand what economic problems they cause when they're not buying U.S. products. It needs to come from within as well.
And are you monetizing this at all? Are you able to make something?
No.
So this is just
I do this completely for free. There's no charge for companies to be listed. There's no advertising. There's no payback for linking to companies or anything like that. And that's the way I wanted to do it, because I would feel bad charging companies money to help promote our economy and our products. And to me, that's hypocritical. I enjoy putting the list together, and I hope it benefits people.
And where are you from?
I was born in Germany, and then I moved to Australia, and then I won a U.S. citizenship in the Green Card Lottery, and that was 20 years ago, and since then, I'm happy to be living in the greatest country in the world.
It's a great story. It's like just over the rainbow, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. Yeah. It was magic to me.
And where do you live, or what area?
I live in New Jersey.
Okay. Well, anything else you want to add? Obviously, let's give the plug for the website, which we'll post on our website as well.
Yeah, it's called usproducts.yolasite, YOLASITE.com. And I think we've covered most of the areas.
Yeah.
The thing is just people need to be aware that companies, I mean the stores, they're there to make a profit. And you as a consumer do have the power to change what they sell. You can't just... I mean, you don't have to take it lying down if they only have imports.
Mm-hmm.
If you suddenly decide to buy U.S. products, they won't be able to sell their imports anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tell your friends and family and coworkers and emphasize that people should be looking at U.S. products first before going for an import, then we can make a difference. We can, because we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs in the U.S. in the last 10 years. And California alone has lost 500,000. And every time you buy an import, you're helping to put someone in the U.S. out of work. But every time you buy a U.S. product, you're helping to keep your fellow Americans employed and help strengthen our economy.
So wonderful. We had a gal on last week who does this for her city. Promotes.
Yes, I was listening to that.
Yeah, and it's so you've taken it to, because her thing is a city strong makes a region strong, makes a state strong, makes the United States strong. So you're taking it to the next level. So thank you so much for your time this morning and for your message, which is also empowering, about one voice, one vote, one paycheck, what we do and how we spend our money does have an effect.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
You're so very welcome. I appreciate your time. And how great is that? So our contact information is on the website and the blog. And thank you so much. Folks are reaching out and they're suggesting topics and they're offering themselves. And, we vet them. And then when we can, we give you an opportunity to share the good word as much as possible. So boomers are at it again. They're in the news today. Because what are we doing now? There are more and more later in life divorces going on. A poll of American divorce lawyers showed that 61% have seen an increase in the number of gray divorces among people over 50 in the United States. Nearly a quarter of gray divorces were initiated by wives, compared to 14% by husbands. So then I'm thinking, okay, so what about the rest of it? It must have been mutual. There's a clear indication that there is a surge in over 50s divorces. So boomers are defined between those born between 1946 and 1964. And they in the study, they quoted several prominent divorce lawyers, one Alton Abramowitz. He's a New York attorney and president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, a boomer himself, attributes the rise in boomer divorce to several factors. People are living longer, they are reaching retirement, the children have left home, relationships have changed, and it's now easier to get a divorce even after decades of marriage. In the United States, statistics show roughly 45% of marriages end in divorce, and the rate is even higher for subsequent marriages. And a report by the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University in Ohio showed that the divorce rate among middle-aged and older adults has doubled during the past two decades, and the rate was 2.5 times higher for remarriages than for first marriages. And so then they quote, like, former Vice President Al Gore and his wife Tipper, after 40 years of marriage, they got divorced. And then another family lawyer in Pennsylvania expects to see more gray divorces in the future. It's so funny they say gray because 50s, we don't have gray hair. Boomers facing mortality are spurred to act if their marriage is not working. People say to me, life is too short. I'm in the last quarter of my life and I am not happy. Get me out of here. And she says they may need that push to get them out, what she calls a springer. You need somebody to spring you from the marriage. So I have a friend who's been married for a long time, I think 30 years. And some of you might be laughing at that because my folks have been married for 58, so I know what a long marriage is. Me? Not, that's not in my repertoire. Anyway, he says, I don't want to spend the rest of the last half of my life with her. And I'm thinking, ugh. So have a great morning. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to visiting with you tomorrow. We've got some fascinating topics booked. We'll share more of those tomorrow morning.